This is where George Bull thinks that an American finally, America's indispensable role is to provide the means of relieving the political leaders on both sides of the need to make politically unpalatable decisions by furnishing them the escape route of yielding reluctantly under the relentless pressure of outside forces. This means that our president must take the political heat from powerful and articulate pro-Israeli domestic groups. It means that as a nation we must be prepared to accept abuse and blame from both sides, permitting local politicians to save their own skins by attacking American arrogance. And after Ball's article was published in Foreign Affairs, Philip M. Klutznik, his friend and prominent member of the Jewish community, wrote a letter to the editor of Foreign Affairs commenting on Ball's article. Ball's reply: "I have such high regard for Philip Klutznik as a man of integrity and perception that I'm extremely reluctant to disagree with him. It would obviously be preferable for the Arabs and Israelis to negotiate a final settlement between themselves. But I cannot believe that such a procedure would succeed. In my article, I pointed out that the requisite conditions to an effective negotiation in the classical mode simply do not exist between the Arabs and Israelis, and, if that was true before the May elections, the victory of the Likud party has powerfully reinforced my dubiety. Can anyone seriously believe that a government headed by a leader who categorically asserts that he will never yield an inch of West Bank territory will be persuaded to make the requisite concessions if the United States merely plays a sideline role, helping to provide a framework for negotiating and submitting concrete proposals from time to time? In some international disputes, there is wide latitude for negotiation since a settlement is often possible with any of several combinations of mutually balancing concessions. But in the Arab-Israeli dispute, each side has explicitly formulated its minimal requirements and passionately asserts that it will not settle unless those requirements are met. Thus the Israelis insist, and with good reason, on a real peace, and will not be content with some vague declaration of non-belligerency. The frontline Arab states, on their part, are never going to agree to a full peace unless Israel commits herself to withdraw from substantially all territory she seized in 1967 and accepts the creation of a Palestinian homeland. Unlike many other situations, there is little room for bargaining within the context of a comprehensive settlement, and, as Mr. Klutznik himself points out, piecemeal steps seem to have no amount of pushing and prodding is likely to force either side to grant the minimal requirement demanded by the other. That can occur, it seems to me, only if the United States says in effect, these are the terms of a settlement, based on the principles propounded by the UN Security Council, which should satisfy each side's minimal requirements. They include powerful enforcement and security measures such as buffer zones with neutral forces, demilitarized areas, and superpower guarantees. If the Arabs reject the US proposals and refuse a full peace, even on the promise of an Israeli withdrawal, we should recognize that another war is inevitable. But if the Arab states do agree to a full peace, as I believe they are likely to do, and the Israelis refuse to accept withdrawal essentially to pre-1967 boundaries, then the United States must face a hard national decision. Can we in good conscience continue to provide huge subsidies to enable Israeli obduracy to perpetuate a stalemate that will sooner or later lead to a catastrophe for all? Do we really want our Middle East policies to be made in Jerusalem, or should we try to stave off disaster by taking a positive position of our own?" Emphasis supplied. George Ball's thoughtful and wise approach to Middle East peace was doomed for two principal reasons. 1. It called for a peaceful solution to be imposed on the parties by the United States. The concept of an imposed solution is anathema to the Israeli lobby, because they interpret it to mean that Israel will inevitably be the sacrificial lamb, too. At the time that Ball wrote the Foreign Affairs article, the Likud party led by Menachem Begin had just come to power, and peace was the last thing they were interested in. Much has changed in the Middle East since 1977, when Ball's Foreign Affairs article was written. For the most part, the changes have been for the worse. On the positive side, however, was the settlement of the sin issue with Anwar Sadat at Camp David in 1979. Another positive development has been the PLO's statements regarding terrorism and the recognition of Israel. However, this is only a temporary reprieve pending Arafat's success or failure in his efforts to bring about a peaceful settlement of the West Bank and Gaza issue. The understanding reached between Arafat and the radical wing of the PLO is that Arafat must soon produce tangible results in his moderate approach or all bets are off. A third, and perhaps the most important potentially positive factor is that Jewish and Israeli intellectuals have, by and large, abandoned the Likud and its West Bank policies. This, however, must be translated into positive steps by the intellectuals to exert their influence. Unless the peace activists organize to provide leadership for the Jewish community in America and the electorate in Israel, their impact unfortunately will be minimal. On the negative side, is the fact that the Likud, which first came to power in 1977, is now fully entrenched. Furthermore, the Likud continues to gain a greater share of the electorate with each succeeding election. This is due, in large part, to a lack of alternatives for the Israeli voters. The leaders of the Likud, as is the case with all demagogues, have simple and emotionally powerful answers to Israel's problems. In contrast, the Labour Party appears weak and indecisive. There is good reason to believe that the Likud's hold on the government could be reduced dramatically if a peace party with a dynamic leadership would challenge the Likud with a plan for peace and security that the Israeli people could believe in. Another very negative development has been the Likud's settlement policies in the occupied territories. In 1977, there were few Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. Since then, the Likud has launched an aggressive settlement program to get as many new settlers as possible to implement Begins Facts on the Ground policy. Many of these new settlements are in close proximity to Palestinian villages which have been there for centuries. A large number of the settlers are religious zealots who consider the Palestinians as the intruders. The result has been a bitter confrontation in which the settlers carry guns and the Palestinians throw rocks. This is the emotional crucible out of which the Intifada was forged. The West Bank settlers, which now number in excess of 70,000, are ideologically the core of the Likud's constituency. Cutting the Gordian knot as a nation, we are often so obsessed with our failures that we neglect to recognize or take credit for our successes. One of the most outstanding of these has been the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. At the end of World War II, there were only two significant military powers in the world, the US and the Soviet Union. When Winston Churchill, in his historic speech in Fulton, Missouri, announced to the world that the hopes for a peaceful post-war Europe had been betrayed, and that an iron curtain had descended from Stettin, in the Baltic, to Trieste, in the Adriatic, the ruined and ravaged nations of Western Europe were huddled around the US like chicks to a mother hen. The Russian bear, still panting after swallowing Eastern Europe, looked to the West, and saw NATO was born as a brave mutual defense pact, comprising most of the nations of Western Europe, as protection against an insatiable Soviet Union. The unique aspect of the NATO alliance was that the US did not simply make a paper commitment to come to the defense of any NATO member under attack, but pledged as security for that commitment to deploy military forces of the US, both land and air, on the frontiers of the NATO countries. This is sometimes called the tripwire. In essence, it acts as a trigger which, when violated, automatically puts into effect a pre-planned and self-executing military response of which all parties, friend and foe, are the deployment of battle-ready units of the US Army and Air Force on European soil as a deterrent to aggression, has been the most successful. The presence of approximately 300,000 American troops in the NATO countries, of course, did not guarantee that the Soviet Union could not successfully overrun Western Europe. But it made unmistakably clear to the Soviets that, if they attempted to do so, the full military and industrial might of the United States would be engaged from day one. The real strength of NATO has, of course, not been the American military presence as such, but the unambiguous nature of the US commitment. If the United States had merely